And with that, I'd like to welcome all to our, what are we at, August 30th Q&A session. And with that, I will send it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And I'm going to start off with a YouTube tech item. In the last few weeks, I've been talking a bit about looking at programming. And I'm currently looking at Qt, which is this Qt thing, which is an integrated development environment, an IDE, for C++. And C and C++ and those kind of languages are a bit off the wall. So finding tutorials which tell you all about it is actually pretty useful, if not necessary. And I found this channel called Void Realms, by a guy called Brian Cairns. And one of his options is, Qt C++ tutorials. And not only that, but he has 154 videos, tutorial videos. And in this C++ section, there's a total of 224 videos.
Wow.
If you want to know anything about Qt and C++, I think it's somewhere in those videos. But not only that, if you go to the website, and if you click on playlists, then you can pull down a whole raft of topics. And here you can see, this is the one I'm currently looking at, the Qt and C++ series. But you see, there's one here on Android, there's one on Python, there's one on Java. And even if you're interested in just making up websites in HTML, he has a whole bunch of 17 videos, tutorial videos on HTML. So if any of these things appeal to you, he's actually a very good teacher, keeps the videos short and to the point, but they're pretty easy to follow, and I highly recommend them. If you have any interest in programming in those particular languages, then that's a really good source. Okay, moving on. We have a follow-up from, I think, last week when we were talking about PowerPoint. Well, Linda was talking about PowerPoint.
Yeah, so Linda was showing how to use PowerPoint for memorials specifically. So basically an unattended presentation and of some seriousness, I guess. And so you don't want to use lots of flash in your PowerPoints for that and so forth. So she had some really good pointers on how to put something like this together. And in the chat window, Carol Pearson said that she was doing a 50th something PowerPoint for a reunion and wanted to add music, and she had actually recorded a song but didn't get to the point of actually trying to put it into the PowerPoint and was wondering a little bit about, is this possible and how would you go about doing it? So next, it's actually easier done than said. And so Alan did a quick search, found a website that talked about how to actually do this, sent it my way so that I could put together the slides. So it was quite good. So basically all you have to do is on your first slide, go to the Insert tab, and then within the Media group, you choose Audio and then Audio on My PC. Next. And then it'll bring up a standard Windows dialog box where you can select a file. So you will browse to wherever your music is, and you select the music file that you want to embed into your PowerPoint. Next. And then once it'll place a speaker icon, usually right in the center of the slide. You can drag it to anywhere else. It won't actually appear when you just play your slides, the slide deck, but you can just drag it to somewhere a little bit more convenient. And then next. Then you you click on it so that it's selected. And then on the playback tab, which should be appearing as soon as you click on that speaker icon, there is an option there to play in background. And then what will happen is when the slideshow is run, the music will play through the entire slideshow. So I think that's probably what Carol was looking for. But a little bit more nuanced than that, if you go to next. So if you wanted the music to stop before the end of the deck, you go to the Animations tab and go to select the Animations pane, and then you double-click on the entry for your music. You may have other animations in your slide there, but somewhere in that slide or the animation pane, you will find your music. So you double-click on that, next. And then you'll get another dialog box. And in the middle of that dialog box, it'll have stop playing, and you just select after and whatever slide number you want. So again, this is only if you wanted to stop playing after a certain number of slides. By default, it will just play to the end of the deck and then restart automatically. Next. So the other parts of this dialog box, just ignore them. They don't apply if you're using play and background. It's only if you're playing a particular piece of sound on one slide as opposed to through the whole deck. Next. Okay, a couple of caveats. So the slideshow normally, you would have it set up so that it loops automatically so that you don't have to restart the deck every time that it ends. So you want this to be an unattended thing that'll just run until you go and hit escape to stop the show. Next. By default, the music will play until the last slide, and it abruptly stops. So there's no fade out or anything like that. It'll just stop at that point. And then it'll immediately restart from the beginning of the song when the slide deck starts up again. So it would be really nice if it just continued to play forever and, you know, when it got to the end of the song, it started replaying the song. But no, it stops the song and then the song will restart when the deck loops to the start. Next. So if you want to do, you could use an external audio editor if you wanted effects such as if you want to put together multiple songs. So your deck is longer than the song. You might want to have two songs or three songs or whatever. And so an external editor would allow you to combine multiple songs together that you would then add to your PowerPoint deck. If you wanted to have a fade, it's kind of nasty when it sort of abruptly ends at the end of the deck. And so you could have it fade out towards the end so it's a little bit nicer sounding. Or if you wanted to edit that song or whatever the sound is, if you wanted to edit for length to match your particular deck, an external audio editor would be the way to go on that. But all in all, really, really simple to do. And it works quite well with the caveats about not having fades and things like that. So that's it for that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And talking about Linda, Linda has some comments and some information, some tips.
Okay, thanks, Alan. So this was just in relation to the fact that probably for the distant future anyway, OPCUG will not be having in-person meetings, but just sort of the odd social outing. And I just feel that it'd be nice to sort of increase my feeling of being part of a larger club than just the people that I see, the faces that I see. Because when I went to the pizza queue, there was lots of people there. I didn't know their names and I didn't recognize their faces because a lot of people don't show their videos. So I encourage members to turn on their video, of course, but there's lots of reasons why perhaps you can't or you don't wish to. That's fine. But it'd be really nice if people at least attached a still photo to render it so that I get to know what the faces look like. And I don't mean Daffy Duck, so I mean a proper face. And then that way, you know, if you do come early, there is a nice chat going on before the Q&A starts where we can see each other very clearly. So anyway, next slide. And so, yeah, so the meeting opens at 7:15. And until 7:25, when Chris starts running the pre-meeting deck, it's kind of that gallery view. So you get to see everybody, and it's really nice if everybody can see each other's faces. Next. So I just wanted to facilitate that if there is anybody who's not sure how to do some of these basic things. I'm certainly no expert, so all I'm showing is what I know. So there could be others that can weigh in on other things. But I just wanted to remind people or show them how to upload a profile picture, how to change your name, how to adjust your video, and how to add a virtual background. Next. but it assumes that you've installed the Zoom desktop client or the mobile app. So that's what I'm basing it on. It's a PC user group, so I'm going to be basing it on what it looks like in my PC. The button locations may vary if you're on an iPad or something like that. It will depend on your platform, but I'm focusing on the PC. Next. So if you want to add a profile picture, you can just open your Zoom application via your start menu, and then you can click on the gear button. Next. And it will bring up this menu, and you see profile on the left, so you click on that. And then you just hover over the little pencil above your name. Next. And you go get your picture, and you bring it in, just get it from Windows Explorer, and you bring it in, and then you can adjust it size-wise, and then hit save. Next.
Once they bring it in, Linda, you're just dragging and dropping into this area?
You can drag and drop, or you can just go get it in your pictures folder and just insert it. Just click on it and insert.
Okay, thanks.
Next. So there it is. That's it. That's all you have to do, and it will always show up when you're on Zoom. Next. Or the other way you can do it, and this is how I did it for mine, was I went to the Zoom.us. Website, logged in, and then went to profile, clicked on the little pencil, and basically it's the same process. Next, you just go get your, it says choose your file, your picture file, so click on that, go get it from your pictures folder. Next, and then the same sort of adjustments you can make before you hit save for your profile picture. Next. So that's it. That's For that, that's all you need to do. Next. So how to change your name. So the bar usually along the bottom, one of them will be participants. Just click on the participants. Next. And you find your name. You click on the three buttons, or the three dots, and you change to another name. So that's particularly handy if you are sharing it with someone. But of course, you'll have to change the profile picture, I guess. I'm not sure how that works. I have a dedicated computer just for me. But anyway, it is nice to change your name depending on your situation. You might be in a meeting where you want your title shown, but for this meeting, you don't need your title, that kind of thing. Next. So to adjust your video appearance, you just go to the video button there and hit the chevron, and up comes the menu video settings. Click on that. Next. And then it brings you into this screen, and it will automatically give you the live view of what you have going on in the background at that moment. So that was my screensaver at that time. And then you can adjust that, touch up my appearance. So basically you can put it left or right to add or subtract years off your face. So it softens your face a little bit. I guess I got it halfway, so I'm sticking with middle age. I like middle age. So, and then you can adjust for low light if you wish. Next. So here's me not looking too happy because I've got this messy background. So I'm going to show you how to do a virtual background. So this is where I'm sitting right now, is in my office. So next. So what you can do is, before, if you don't want to do a virtual background, or your cam doesn't like to do a virtual background, you can just blur your background. So again, you click on the video button, and then you click on blur my background. Next. And now I'm looking happier, and my background is just nice and softened. Next. Okay, so adding a virtual background, you can do it while you're, you know, live on the Zoom. You can click on your video button, choose virtual background. And then it used to give some examples or stock images. It doesn't seem to do that anymore. So you just click on add images, and the ones you see there are ones that I've added from my own photos. So you can add as many as you want. Unfortunately, every time it does an update, it deletes all of them like it did yesterday, and then you have to go load them all again. But c'est la vie, it encourages you to put in new photos, I guess. So next.
It's interesting because I've had a number of updates and it hasn't deleted my background.
Oh, you're lucky. It does it every time with mine and every time with Chris's.
Me too, yeah. And what I do, what I've taken to doing is I make sure that I have a folder which has all of the virtual background photos that I want to use, drop them in there, and then go add them one by one.
But you have to add them one by one.
But they're all in one location.
I wish I could add them all at the same time. But anyway, next. So I just wanted to point out you can also set your blur from this screen as well. Okay, next. Now, the other way you can do it is you can go to your Zoom application again via your start menu, and where we had clicked on profiles earlier in my slides, you could click on background effects, and you basically get the same options. But what was interesting is I don't see that avatar's beta when I'm on, when you're on the Zoom, so maybe you can only get to it. I didn't try it because I have a hard time sometimes backing these things up, but I wasn't going to take a chance. But anyway, that is on that screen, but it's not on the previous screen where I was live on Zoom. So just FYI on that. And next, I think that might be it. Is that it?
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. Okay. We do have a question in the Q&A, in the chat from Martin. When you add a profile photo, is this specific to OPC UG Zoom calls or any Zoom call where you – and I assume you actually meant choose video.
Yeah, no, it would appear in any Zoom call that you attended. It would use that profile picture. Doesn't have to be OPCUG specific.
Okay, thanks very much, Linda. So we hope next week we'll see everybody on webcams or profile pictures, and the gallery will just be full of color.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Linda.
Okay, next up we have a Stuart on Android feature.
Ah, yes, what have I got? Statista, the website, the myth, the legend. Did I write that? Gee, darn, I'm good. What can I say? I don't know how many of you have heard of the website Statista, but it's full of statistics of all sorts, and graphs and records, and it's rather overwhelming. But they now have an Android and iOS application that you can put on your mobile, and it's called the Statista Daily Data, sort of what's cool and interesting today, or if you want to get more deeply into it, you can. But they say it's available for both Android and iOS. It looks better to me on a tablet. Maybe it's because my eyes are getting older. Bigger screen, I like that. Helps out with the graphs. And the landing page is, of course, the editor's pick of the day. There'll be some sort of relevant information about this day in history, or this day as of something that's important to the editor or whatever, but there will be information on that. And today is actually disappearances continuing in Syria, and statistics and graphs on that. And if you scroll to the left or right, you get more information on that particular topic. And if you scroll up or down, you get more information on that, and then you get more information on other things. Behind the news, half of Americans live in states where weed is legal. That's wonderful. I'm very happy for them. And more information on that, and more information on that. Anyway, that's just the landing page. There's also, if you look at the menu at the bottom from home, you go over and there's topics. If you hit that, you will get, I was going to use some term, but there is a lot of topics in alphabetical order: advertising and marketing, agriculture, chemicals and resources, construction, and I'm not going to scroll down, but that's what's on my screen at the moment. And in each topic, you can scroll left or right to increase your knowledge on that particular topic. You know, it's a great time waster, or a great way to find out some information quickly. And of course, on the bottom menu, you can have your favorites, so you don't have to waste your time with this massive menu of irrelevant information. You can drill right into the relevant information for you. I've only just played around with this a little bit. I thought it would be of interest to some people in the group, so that's Statista. Get your feet wet.
Thanks, Stuart. Tom wants to know if you use something called Wolfram Alpha.
Wolfram, that sounds like an old video game, shooter game from the 80s. Castle Wolfram? No.
I thought that was Wolfenstein or something. But yeah, Wolfram. I thought it was a mathematical application, Wolfram.
I'm not sure. Anyway, I've asked Tom in the chat here. So we'll see. Okay, thanks
so much, Stuart. It's a combination. Wolfram Alpha is a kind of a combination of Google and, I don't know, MATLAB. You can do a variety of, you can ask for a variety of statistics and other information and do mathematical stuff with them.
Okay. Interesting.
All right, thanks very much, Stuart. So we'll look forward to the next episode and whatever you have for us. In the meantime, we'll move on to another part of our looking at how to speed up computers, and in particular, how to look at what PC Manager can and can't do for us. And if you remember, we've been playing around with PC Manager mainly trying to get rid of junk files, temporary files. So here I had 1.2 megabytes of temporary files, and I believe we were using storage management at this point. And when we go to storage management, we get the option to do a deep clean, and we have all these different things on the left. So it gives us categories of things that we can try and eliminate. And you can see, indeed, I do have 1.1 gigabytes of total system cleanup here. Microsoft kindly didn't include Edge's temporary files, which are 28 megabytes. Since I don't use Edge, I don't know why there are temporary files there anyway, but I'm happy enough to click everything and try and make everything go away. And of course, I say proceed, and not everything does go away. I've gone down from 1.1 gigabytes of junk files, and it says it's free 1.1 gigabytes, but there's still 170 meg of temporary files, which presumably, again, are these in-use files, in use right now, we can't delete them sort of thing. But certainly we've got rid of about a gig of junk files, so that's good. However, as usual, I go and look at my disk cleanup settings, and there's only 22 meg in the general one. But if I hit cleanup system files, there's been a Windows update here, and it's left 5 gigabytes of temporary files in the update folder, just in case I want to roll back the Windows update, which I never do. So I'm happy to basically say, okay, wait for this cleanup to get rid of this 5 gigabytes of files and add it to my free space.
Alan, if I can interrupt, it's really curious that PC Manager, in its category for Windows Update cleanup, only found just over a gig, and disk cleanup found 5 gigs. Like, if you go back one more slide.
Yeah, but I think that's because this 5 gigabytes is relatively new.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Okay.
With Microsoft saying, well, wait a minute, you may want to roll back the update, so we better keep this 5 gigabytes of file handy just in case.
Okay, gotcha.
I don't know what happens if you leave it there and run PC Manager, you know, 2 weeks later. In theory, Windows should have deleted it anyway by then. But if the files are still there, does PC Manager kick in and say, oh, I'll get rid of them for you or not?
Yeah.
I don't know.
See? Windows Update cleanup won't automatically get rid of a lot of the stuff based on the idea that it thinks, in case you want to be able to roll back, But eventually things get to the point where you can't roll back to something, and so it will clean up things that you can't roll back to that anyways. So it does some automatic cleanup, but it's not a wholesale thing for by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay, I was under the impression that it kept these update files around for a week or 10 days or something and then deleted them.
Nope. They'll be around longer than that.
Oh, well. Well, maybe that's why I use disk cleanup a lot, because I can't afford 5 gigabytes of junk files. All right, it's interesting, though. Even so, there's 5 gigabytes here which disk cleanup says it wants to delete for me. But look what happened. Before we started this mess, I had 3.1 gigabytes of free space. And now I've got 6.2 gigabytes of free space, which by my mathematics is it's created extra three gigabytes of free space, even though it had, was it 5.7 gigabytes available?
5.07.
So it had 5 gigabytes, but somehow it only managed to create 3 gigabytes extra of free space. So Microsoft needs to take a lesson from Statista or Wolfram or Alpha or something, because their accounting system just doesn't make any sense to me. Anyway, so the bottom line, as far as I can see, is you can run PC Manager as much as you like, but you're going to end up having to run disk cleanup as well. And even then, who knows whether you got rid of all the files or not. I think you have to maybe dig manually with File Explorer to see what's going on. However, Storage Manager and that management system we were just looking at, as well as deep cleanup, it has this option to manage large files. It says it looks for large files in the C drive. So if you click on this, sure enough, by default, it's going to look for anything over 10 megabytes. I thought that was a bit restrictive, so I changed that, and I opted to go with the greater than 50 megabyte radio button. And then I click on View These Files in File Explorer. So let's see what's on my system, which are bigger than 50 megabytes. And sure enough, there's some here, 67 megabytes, 55 megabytes, 98 megabytes, and so on. Some of these you probably recognize. I recognize PDFs on BASIC, because that's a PDF utility program that allows me to merge PDF files, split PDF files, and do all kinds of wonderful things with PDF files. And so I use that, and I'm pretty happy to have it installed. I doubt I can do anything with Windows Desktop Runtime, Windows X64. That really sounds like a Microsoft program. Here's another interesting one, PowerToy Setup. It's using almost 100 meg of disk space. I only use 2 utilities in that package, but of course I have to install everything if I want to use those. These Samsung Magician ones are a utility for my solid-state drive. They're taking 100 meg between them, but I do use it once in a blue moon. So again, it's probably a good thing to have. The other one that's interesting is LG Hub here. Well, we'll see what that is in a second. But supposing you don't know what these things are, how are you going to find out what PDF Sam Basic is? Well, basically go to this listing here, do a right click, and then select properties, and it will show you that the location of this file is in C colon program data, and then there's a folder called PDF Sam Basic, and it's an MSI file here. And so you have to decide whether or not you can delete those kind of things. And if they're in C colon program data, it probably means that it's part of installed programs and you probably can't do much about those things. Just out of interest, I think I also tried the greater than 10 megabyte option. And you see, I don't get that many more, but there are a few more extra ones here. Skype, for example, down here, which I don't use on my PC, but it's using 40 meg, so can I get rid of that? I actually don't know. But the ones that are interesting to me are these three right here, LG Hub. This is LG Hub is part of a Logitech utility to do with my mouse. And it's using, 10, 40, 140 megabytes of stuff. And I don't actually use this. And it's really interesting. If I go to C colon program files and look for the folder, it's using almost 300 megabytes of disk storage, this utility program. If I look in a control panel under the uninstall or change the program, it lists a couple of packages here. There's the LG Hub program and some kind of utility for the capturing stuff with the mouse or whatever, or a webcam, I don't know what that is. But interestingly, it doesn't show any sizes here. So if you just look here, you got no idea how much this stuff is taking. And the other thing is, do you know what LG Hub is anyway? Well, Mr. Google is always your friend. Put in LG Hub and see what he says. And sure enough, it tells you that this is Logitech's G Hub advanced gaming software. Customize your mice, keyboards, speakers, webcams, using their prearranged software. Well, again, if you never use this, if you're not a gamer or you don't have to modify your webcam with this utility program, here's where you can save yourself 300 megabytes by deleting this whole package. And just as an aside, I actually ran PC Manager on a different computer of mine, and this one is showing a whole bunch of different programs. This looks like it's the over 50 megabyte one. This one's kind of interesting. CodeMeter Runtime 64 and Runtime 32. I would have thought I would only need one of these. If I'm running a 64-bit chip, I'd be running the 64-bit installation. So why I've got two installed, I don't know. I actually don't know. I didn't know what CodeMeter was, but it turns out it's a program associated with a proprietary piece of software that I use for event data recorder analysis. And this is a package which basically checks that I've got a licensed copy of their program. And this has just appeared quite recently. I've never seen this CodeMeter thing before. So I'm a bit upset about that. This Reflect patch here, which is a program belonging to Macrium Reflect, and as you know, that's going away, so I probably don't need that. And here's a program, teams.exe, that's Microsoft Teams. I don't use Microsoft Teams. Again, I don't know whether I'm allowed to delete Microsoft Teams. That's something I have to check on. And here's another interesting one, some kind of video drivers. This is version 15.2. This is version 20.19, and there seems to be, if this is the new one, why do I have the old one? And there seems to be two copies of the new one, which is kind of weird, especially since they're both taking 200 megabytes of disk storage. So those are kind of files which I would have to now go and find out from Mr. Google what they are, check in File Explorer where they are, what they do, can I get rid of them or not. However, another interesting thing here is that I've got this thing called March in Ottawa, which is a video file, an MP4 file, which is 50 meg. But I've got one down here called Young Messiah, which is a video file. It's 2.3 gigabytes sitting on my hard drive. So this is, actually I know what this is, it's a video of a upbeat version of Handel's Messiah. But it's a file which I created quite a long time ago. It looks like I created it in 2015, and I've probably forgotten about it. So here's a program, a file which is taking more than two gig of space, and I've really forgotten about it because it's tucked away somewhere deep dark in the file directory, probably in Microsoft's videos. Infamous videos file directory somewhere. So by using this find the large files aspect of PC Manager, It can clue you into some files which are large, and maybe you can dig in and find out whether you can eliminate them or not. And it can certainly remind you if you've got huge files which are left over from previous use and maybe you don't actually need, or maybe you can just archive them onto a external USB somewhere and don't take up space on your current file folder. So I think that's basically covered all of the aspects in PC Manager that deal with file sizes and eliminating temporary files and all those kind of things. And so the question is, what's next? Well, you have to tune in maybe next week and we'll see what else PC Manager has to offer. Okay, that's it for me. I don't know whether there's anything came of that, Chris.
There are a couple of things in the chat. Tom was saying that if you're using a hard disk, do not delete prefetch. There's nothing dangerous about deleting prefetch. It's just that it'll impact your performance on your computer if you do while it rebuilds prefetch. And so you can't really get rid of it permanently, I guess. He also says you can use DISM, which is the, I forget what it stands for. It's usually used in deployment. It's deployment something. It's usually used for deploying the operating system in corporate environments and things like that. It can also be used to repair a damaged Windows installation. And according to Tom, you can actually use DISM to extend the keeping of the old OS update stuff for around 60 days instead of the whatever it is now. It used to be 30, and I think they dropped it down to 15 for major updates because they do take up a fair amount of space. He also commented that maybe the differences, some of it might have come about because the files are compressed, and certainly Windows Update does keep old versions in a compressed format, so maybe it didn't realize, which it should be able to realize, what the footprint on disk is as opposed to the uncompressed version of it. And he also said that for the MSI files, which you had commented on, MSI files and most executables are installs, and they can usually, you can get the download for the latest version if you need it. But still, I think Alan was cautioning that be careful about deleting things willy-nilly that you don't know what they are because it may have unintended consequences. But the MSI files can be pretty big. I found in particular on my system that the NVIDIA video drivers, it keeps around old versions of those forever if you don't delete them. And they can be huge. And so I periodically do go in and delete my older versions of the video drivers that periodically get updated.
The prefetch files are used in the when Windows starts up. Basically, it keeps a track of what things get loaded in what order, and then it strings them out on the disk, all contiguous, so it can just read through when Windows starts up. Useful for a hard disk, but it doesn't matter if you have an SSD. And in fact, the biggest thing you can do to speed up an old PC is to install a SSD.
Yeah. But the prefetch files, they will get rebuilt automatically anyways, huh?
I would think so, because they prefetch, so it inspects them when it needs them.
Well, the whole idea of it getting things in order and things like that, and so that they load quicker, that's an automatic process that it periodically does. So if you delete the prefetch, you eventually will get all of those prefetch files coming back. I'm not sure the trigger on that. Do you know, Tom, the trigger on what creates the prefetch files?
I believe that they get, I'm not sure when they get created, but I believe that the Windows takes a look at them over time and okay, slowly optimizes them according to, you know, which ones get loaded in what order.
Okay.
But I don't know how long it takes. It might, but I think it's more than just one reboot.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
That's a bit weird. You were talking about MSI files though, Chris. When I download software to install, I always put it in the same file folder so I can go in there and throw stuff away eventually. But it looks as though some MSI files get squirreled away in that C:\programfiles folder.
Yeah. When you run an executable to install a program, it may actually not create, but part of the installation file is within it. There's an MSI file that gets written to somewhere. One of the things that MSI files can be used for is repairing an installation. So if you go to, they go to the uninstall on some programs, they actually have an option, repair this application. And that can be done through an MSI file. And so in that case, it's the installation program has squirreled away the MSI file. Can also be used for the uninstall. So when you go to remove it, if you've removed the MSI file, you may have a problem uninstalling the program. So that comes down to the idea that if you're not sure what something is used for, probably best to leave it there unless you're really, really pinched for space.
Yeah, that sounds right. Okay, thanks everyone for the comments. So moving along, we have a share from Chris.
Okay, before I get started, this is the last item on the agenda tonight, so we will be moving into the last 10. So get your final questions and comments and things like that all lined up, and after this item, we'll move right into that. So a bit of history, I guess. We have a habit periodically warning about how scams come out by email, and you don't click on something in an email because it's probably a scam and they're trying to trick you into something where you'll give away personal information or it'll take you to a malicious site which will attack your computer and on and on and on. Well, the other day I got an email, and basically it said it was from Facebook, security@facebookmail.com, and it said someone may have accessed your account. And you go down into the body of it, and it says, looks like somebody may have accessed your account. To secure your account, you need to answer a few questions and so forth to unlock your account. And for your protection, nobody will be able to see your Facebook feed until you actually do secure your account. So, and there's a nice helpful button right there for secure your account now. Next. So my first thought was, yeah, right. Okay, I have long, complex passwords on all my online accounts. Password is not used anywhere else. There's no way that anyone managed to access my Facebook account. So, next. It was obviously a scam. So there's no way I was going to click on secure your account now. But if I hovered my mouse over top of it, it said it linked to www.facebook.com/ and a whole bunch of other stuff. Well, that actually doesn't look like it's taking me to a malicious site. It looks like it's a Facebook property that it's going to send me to. So kind of curious that this actually looks a little bit more legit. Next. So my first inclination was to just ignore it. And next. So I decided, well, rather than just ignore it, let me check it out and see if I can validate whether it's for real or not. So I didn't click the secure your account now, but I went to a tab in my browser, which already had Facebook loaded on it. And to my surprise, instead of seeing normal Facebook content, it was a page that was basically echoing what was in this email, saying that my account, somebody may have accessed my account and my account was now locked, and it included a button to unlock the account. And I do apologize. I should have known enough to do screen caps of those pages, but I didn't. I was sort of flabbergasted at that point. So next. So did I click on the button to unlock my account? No, I did not do that. Next. So the first thing I did was I decided, okay, the page I was on there, which said that it was Facebook, it had been my Facebook normal feed. It was a secure page, so there was a lock beside the URL on the URL bar. And you can click the lock beside the URL. Next. And then you'll get a pop-down, and it says one of the options is connection is secure, and there's a caret going off to the right. Next. And then you can click on more information. Next. And it brings up information about the particular site. Now, it all looked okay, except I was really kind of curious why, with a certificate for Facebook.com, why does it say this website does not supply ownership information? I thought that was kind of curious. I'm not necessarily wrong, but I thought it's curious that Facebook wouldn't assert its ownership information in its certificate. So next, I clicked on View Certificate. Next. And then I got down to where it had all the real nitty-gritty about the actual certificate, and it actually looked sort of legit. So the common name star.facebook.com. So this applies to any facebook.com property. And if I look at the alt names for it, you know, you have star.facebook.com, you have facebook.net, you know, all kinds of other Facebook properties that are out there. So it actually kind of looked like the certificate was legit. So this was a secure connection I had to a Facebook website that was actually telling me that my account had been locked and all the rest of it. So next. So then at that point, I went back to that webpage, not the email. I went back to that webpage and I clicked on that thing to unlock my account. And then I had to answer a couple of questions and so forth. And then my normal feed appeared and everything has been fine since then. Now, I probably could have actually changed my password as well. And in the, for the most paranoid, it might be worth changing the password, but I don't think that this actually was anything malicious at all. What had happened in the hour before I got that email was that I had used a different browser to access a Facebook group that I'm on for my photo editor. I'm on Photo Raw. They have a beta program. And I had just posted something to that group. That's the only thing that I can think of that I did that was out of the ordinary on Facebook. I never really use Facebook at all, but I had to use it for this Facebook group for the beta program. It's the only way that you can interact with the beta program for Online Photo Raw. So I did relent and use it for that. But that was the only thing that I thought of that somehow possibly triggered this idea that I was posting to this group that I don't normally post to, and therefore somebody else was using my account or something. I don't know. But I didn't bother changing my password. As I said, it is a long and complex password. I'm pretty sure that nobody has gotten access to my account. And next. So was I okay with clicking, or why was it okay that I clicked on that button on the webpage to unlock the account? So first off, I didn't click a link in email. So that definitely is something you should not do. If you are told, oh, click here to fix the problem, manually go to the website of the whatever service is in question. You know the URL, how to get there. So go there manually. Don't click the link in the email if you think that there's any chance that this is malicious. And then the page that I was on was www.facebook.com, and I checked the certificate. And I verified that it really was a Facebook website. And then I felt confident that I could actually click on the website to say unlock my account and carry on with that. And it was not something malicious at that point in time. And that's it.
Chris, Ed Morawski says this same thing happened to him today from Rogers asking to unlock his Rogers account. Hmm. So I guess the same kind of process should be followed in that case too.
Yeah, I would. Certainly don't unlock it from the email. Go to Rogers, find out if your account truly is locked. Rogers is a special case too in that you can actually phone somebody at Rogers and talk to them and say, you know, I got this email. Is this really legitimate emails that you people are sending out? But you should be able to go manually to the Rogers website. If it is saying your account is locked, verify that you're really on a Rogers site, and then I would think that it's pretty safe to go ahead and do the process through the website to unlock it.
Okay, Carol has a question, Chris. She says, I was going to use a password manager, but I don't know how they work. I downloaded Bitwarden. I went to put some info in and realized I didn't know how it works. And so, questions. Is a password manager just a storage tool?
Yes. So the, what a password manager is designed to do is it's like a database, and you have one strong password that you create and make sure that it's a strong password that locks up the database. Once you put in that one password to unlock the password database, then you have access to everything that you've stored inside it. So within it, you will have entries for Facebook, for Twitter, for your email, for your banking, all of the different services that you use online, and you can create an entry that has the username and the password, as well as any other relevant information, you know, maybe when a subscription expires, or your passport number, or a phone number for support at a site, or whatever information is relevant to that particular website or service.
And two things, I guess. If you're going to use a long, complex password, make sure you know what it is, write it down, put it somewhere, because you're going to need that to access this encrypted database.
Yeah.
And secondly, it's not just for passwords. You can store all kinds of stuff in a password manager, and Chris has a thing, I think, on Q&A, which discusses that, so that might be something to look for.
Yep.
Next question, Chris. She says, if I go to sign into a website, what do I put in? Does the program recognize the URL and automatically put in the password? It's pretty simple, but I don't see how it works.
Yeah, it's one of those that depends answers. Most password managers do have the ability to log you in based on the URL of the sign-in page. Some of them will require that you put in a hotkey or something like that to say, oh, okay, go look up my information for this particular site and then plug in the information. One password manager that a lot of people use, and I actually use it for stuff that I don't particularly care too much about, like a game at pogo.com. And so I use the built-in password manager in Chrome to actually log me in automatically to that. And that one is really, really simple to use. When you log into a site in Chrome or any Chromium-based browser, and probably most of the other browsers as well, they will pop up and they'll say, do you want me to save this information for you so that it can log in automatically in the future? And if you do so, then it'll save it in its own password manager. It's somewhat protected. It is kept protected. If you try to go into the settings for the browser and go to the password manager, it will ask you to provide your logon credentials for Windows, because unless you've protected the profile for the browser, the only assurance it can have is if you know how to log into Windows. Well, if you have other people who know your login password to Windows, then they could actually access all of your passwords as well. So you have to be a little bit cognizant of those sort of issues. But yes, the long and short is that most password managers will allow you to log in automatically at websites using its password database. And I would just look to the help file for the particular password manager in question. In this case, Bitwarden. I happen to use KeePass, which is a free and open source password manager. I've given presentations on it before. It is a little bit more cumbersome than I think Bitwarden is for setting up automatic login, but it's definitely a doable thing.
Yeah, I use KeePass too. I find that sometimes I can just double click on the link in my password manager and it will open the website, and sometimes it doesn't. But the really good thing is that and once I get to the website, I can just, I think I have to double click on the login user ID and then just paste it into the login form and then do the same thing with the password. I find it's really, really quick and very convenient.
Yeah, it's not terribly convoluted to do it that way for sure.
And you can, as Chris said, you can write a little script to make it work. And again, I highly recommend looking at Chris's past presentations on this, because he's covered all of this stuff and in really good detail.
Okay, thanks.
So Ed says his problem with Rogers was definitely a scam. The email address wasn't from Rogers.
Yeah, that's a pretty telling thing.
Okay, we've still got 5 minutes, our last 10, so if there's any other questions, we're open for business.
I see as we're waiting for those to come in the case of Bitwarden, you do have to put a browser plugin to automate your login process, which actually kind of makes sense because in that case, if you have a Bitwarden plugin, then within the browser, it understands how to talk to the Bitwarden database. And so if you go to a login, it knows that if it's not unlocked, it'll pop up and ask you for your credentials to open up the database, and then it knows how to talk to the entries within the Bitwarden database so that it can log you in automatically. KeePass doesn't have a browser plugin to do that, but what they do is they basically tie it to a URL for the login page. If that is part of the entry within KeePass, then you can have it feed keystrokes through automatically, and it has a default, which is put in your username, tab, put in your password, enter, which for most websites that works, but you can customize that for other login situations where maybe you put in some sites you put in your username, you hit enter, and then you get another page come up, then you put in your password, and then you hit enter again. So you can customize these, and then with a single hotkey, you can have it feed those keystrokes through based on it finding out, you know, within the database, which website am I on, and therefore feed those credentials through to log you into the page. So it can be done with a single hotkey for the vast majority of websites.
One of the ways of detecting whether an email is spam or fake is to look at all the headers. I know how to do it in Pegasus, which is what I use as an email program, but I presume there are other ways and other programs like Google and others where people access their email. Are people familiar with that?
Probably not. Yeah, I find that most of the spammers and scammers, they don't even really try to hide their tracks at all. They'll have a display name that'll say, Rogers Tech Support or something like that or whatever. But if you look at the email address, it'll be, example.finance.com or something like that. You know, it'll just be some random thing. So it's pretty easy to tell that, this is not really Rogers that is trying to contact you or trying to get you to click their link. The other thing is usually if you hover your mouse over top of their button that they put in to click here to fix the problem, you'll see that it's not going to Rogers.com. It's going to some totally different site. And so you know that it's a scammer at that point in time. Another way of tracing spam is spamcop.net, but it's a little bit convoluted, but it is kind of neat the way it'll track things back, and it'll also offer to send complaint messages to the administrators of whoever it is that is doing improper forwarding of faked emails and things like that. So I've sometimes used it.
So Jeff in the chat window says he's using the Brave browser, and he allows it to save login credentials on some sites, but doesn't allow passwords to be synced across machines. So the browser's password manager is local to that machine only, but he does sync bookmarks.
Yeah. And as I said, I use it, the Chrome password manager for quite a bit of the stuff. I don't use it for my bank accounts and things that are of high value to me. I don't use it for the email that is a recovery email for other sites. So for those, I only keep it in KeePass, which is a couple of extra keystrokes for me to get to, but it's much more secure than leaving it in my browser's password manager, iBank.
So Jeff has a note here that a program called mxtoolbox.com, our website, allows you to cut and paste the header information from emails, I imagine. And Elizabeth wants to know if showing the headers is the same as show original.
Generally speaking, yes. Show original will usually show you the raw email itself, which includes the headers at the top. And so if you're doing that, what you want to do is go to the show original, scroll up to the top, and you'll see all kinds of header information. Let me just see if I can bring up one.
An example in the chat here, Chris.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can't find a way to get it in this anyways right now. So, well, there is a view. Yeah. Yeah, message source is another thing where they'll say view message source will actually give it to you as well. I can actually share this really quickly and show you. Stop that sharing. And source of, there we go. Okay. So this is a message with the message headers. So it's pretty short. On the news, I think they said 7 degrees overnight. That's the actual email. But this top part here where you have all these return paths, the date, subject, all the way down until you get to basically through there, I guess, is all message header stuff. So that's the stuff that you would actually paste in. And some of the received headers, you might have a dozen received headers that are all in there. This was rather direct because it was going Gmail to Gmail. But if it's going through different mail systems and things like that, you can end up with lots and lots of received headers. So that's what's meant by pasting in the headers of the message. And in this case, this was in Thunderbird, and it was gotten to by going view and message source, and it brought up the entire raw, what was sent out by the SMTP protocol.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, so we're over just over 8:30 now, so let me just wrap up by saying that this is the last day of August. I can never find my control. So soon we'll be starting our fall season of regular meetings, regular monthly meetings, and the September meeting is going to be on September 13th, and it's going to be Serge Eric who's going to be talking about Directory Opus, which is a replacement for, or an alternative, I guess, for Windows Explorer. So this must be a program Serge Eric uses quite a bit, and he's going to tell us all about it. So that's on September the 13th. And before that, next week, our next Q&A will be Wednesday, September the 6th. So if you have questions or items that you'd like to share, something like the things you've seen tonight, we're always looking for new material, just send us a note to suggestion box at opcud.ca, and we'll fit you into the program. So thanks very much for everyone for attending tonight. I hope you enjoyed the many and varied content. Thanks for everyone who made the presentations, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks.